what I've been asked to do, basically, is come up and bring a workshop, bring a big book workshop up to this group. And I'm always honored and privileged and grateful to be offered an opportunity to do that. I do this quite a bit around the country and other places. So I've got some experience doing big book workshops. And you know, one of the things that's very, very true about a big book workshop is the learning and studying of the 12 steps and the learning and the studying of the book Alcoholics Anonymous is near worthless without the motivation and the actual application of the specific instructions in it. What the book Alcoholics Anonymous is really designed to do is to offer the individuals who are going through it and following directions an actual recovery experience, an experience that that brings about a transformational personality change. You go from being a hopeless alcoholic, which is basically someone who does not have the ability to predict or have the power of choice and control to with alcohol to be able to stay sober and move forward with their lives. You go from a hopeless alcoholic to someone in a state called recovered when you follow the guidelines in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's very, very important for all of us to know that, but knowing it doesn't generate the experience. Doing it generates the experience. One of the sad things that's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous today, not so much below the Mason-Dixon line as I've learned, more so in the Northeast where I come from, one of the sad things that's happened is Alcoholics Anonymous has become a place of gathering and sharing, which is fine unless you're in real trouble. If you're in real trouble with alcoholism, you need a vital spiritual experience. And that's not going to happen by gathering and sharing. Going to meetings does not treat alcoholism. What going to meetings does is it provides an atmosphere where someone can hopefully stay sober long enough to be able to find a recovery experience. So you find recovery in the fellowship if you're lucky today. But there are a lot of places and there are a lot of groups and there's a lot of individuals who never find recovery in the fellowship. They find fellowship in the fellowship. And I believe that's why there's a huge difference in recovery rates and long-term sobriety rates today than there has been there has been in the past. One of the things that I believe very, very strongly in is maintaining the primacy, maintaining the importance of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm from the New York area, and I sponsor a grapevine editor. I'm personal friends with a number of trustees on the board of directors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm invited every single year to the service conference on Times Square. I know a lot of these people. I've been invited to be a board member on Alcoholics Anonymous as a Class 2 trustee. I know what goes on there, and sometimes the good is the enemy of the best. This was a statement that Bill Wilson used to say quite often. The good can sometimes be the enemy of the best, and I see that there's a lot of good that's coming out of New York, but when you put it up against this book, the transformational experience that you get when you go through the 12 steps, when you put some of their other literature up against it, you'll see that it doesn't compare. You know, books like Living Sober, some of the pamphlets, they're good. There's good information in them, but they do not offer a transformational experience called The State of Recovered that the book Alcoholics Anonymous does. So there's a lot of things that go on. There's a lot of stuff that happens that contributes to the watering down and the pulling away from some of the principles and practices that have really, really worked well in the past. Every once in a while, someone says, "You know, Chris, you and that newfangled stuff that you're talking about." What I talk about is not newfangled. What I basically share is first decade AA. You know, back when they were running around and they were pulling people off of bar stools and they were going into the insane asylums and they were pulling people out of the hospital detox units and they weren't offering them a ride to a meeting. They were offering them a ride through the steps. And back in those early days, that's when this whole thing was built, and that's when a lot of the miracles that we're here because of happened. And you know, I am a traditionalist, and I am a big book guy, and I make no apology for that. I've been around long enough. I've worked with enough people. I've seen enough people go in and out of this fellowship that you can't even imagine. And I know a few things. One of them is the people that pay real strict attention to what's in this book and really try to practice these principles, those people stay around. And they're here year after year after year, card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing, working with other alcoholics, and their quality of life gets better every single year. The people who come in and believe that this is a sharing program, you know, I'm just going to come and share, and, you know, I'm going to throw a dollar in the basket, and, you know, I'm going home and get, you know, jump right back into the dysfunction of my life, those people usually aren't around 5 years out, 10 years out. And if they are, they're cranky. You know, they're the type of people who don't get better. And they, you know, that life is still, you know, a veil of tears, and it, you know, they still struggle with the same things they were struggling with 5 and 10 years before. So that's what I see. I see that we're offered not only an opportunity to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but we're the recovery process itself brings about an incredibly improved quality of life. You know, that's really the good news. The bad news is we suffer from a progressively fatal illness. Okay, it always gets worse, it never gets better. That's the bad news. The good news is if you put it in remission through practicing the principles in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, year after year, after month, after decade, what happens is spirituality becomes more important. You start to develop a better self-esteem because you're doing esteemable acts. You start to outgrow fear. You start to lose your resentments. You start to become more effective with life. You start to get out of your own way and stop shooting yourself in the foot all the time. And as this happens, your life gets more valuable. It gets better. You become more of what God intended you to be, and more of what the potential that you have. Has anybody in here ever been told back when you were drinking or in school that you had a lot of potential? You know, we do. We've got a lot of potential, but we're shooting ourselves in the foot all the time because we're alcoholic. Another thing that's important as we start moving through this book is we're going to spend probably the first 4 weeks on step one. Why are we going to do that? Well, because Bill Wilson and the first 100, as they put this book together, understood that we don't get step one. We don't get it. It's, you know, instincts balk at investigation. Who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Glass in hand, we've warped our minds to such a state that only an act of divine providence can restore us to sanity. You know, that's out of the step book. Who among us really wants to go there? So what we do is we half measure step one. And if you look in the big book, the first 40-some pages, including the Roman numerals, are all covering step one. And really, step one moves right up into the chapter, We Agnostics. So if you look at it, at least a third of the working part of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is concerned with step one. That's why we're going to take about 4 weeks on it as we move through this work. Because I'm gonna include myself among us. We don't get it. If we had alcoholism does not allow you the dignity of an accurate self-appraisal. And that's long after you've gotten sober. It is an illness of minimization. It's an illness of rationalization, and it's an illness of spiritual laziness. That's just really what it is, inherent in the illness. So this is what we need God for. This is what we need the fellowship and each other for. We need to continue to try to develop enthusiasm, the enthusiasm to recover, because that enthusiasm is usually not there. That's one of the things that kills alcoholics more than anything else, is a lack of enthusiasm to recover. Has anybody in here worked with people who, you know, their life is on fire, and all you're trying to do is get them to go to some consistent meetings, and they're too busy, or they've got other ideas, or all these the steps and all these meetings, it's kind of an overreaction to a problem. I really think I got under control. You got nothing under control. You're living in a car. You know what I mean? It's sometimes you got a hospital wristband on you, on your wrist. You've got nothing under control, and you won't for years, How many people really get it? I know when I first wandered into Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew alcohol was killing me. But I didn't have a clue about how damaging alcoholism was. I thought my problem was drinking too much. If my problem really was drinking too much, stopping drinking too much would have solved my problem. That's not what happened with me. When you're alcoholic, alcohol is a treatment for alcoholism. It's one of the reasons why we drink. It's a bad treatment. It backfires on you. It's not recommended, but it's a treatment for the spiritual malady known as alcoholism. And it talks about all of this in this book. It talks about a lot of things that you just don't hear in meetings anymore. It's become unpopular to talk about powerlessness. It's become unpopular to talk about adherence to spiritual principles. And it's become unpopular to talk about reliance on God. It's become very, very popular to share your drama du jour. Oh, here's what's going on in my life today. Oh, and if you were here last week, let me catch you up on, the drama in my life. Tell somebody who cares. You know what I mean? I'm dying from alcoholism. I need an experience. I need a recovery experience. I'm not interested. Okay? If you're going to complain week after month after year about the same stuff, you have work to do. There's a recovery experience that you're not allowing yourself. Because if you went through the steps, you wouldn't be whining about that stuff week after month after year. You would be interested in helping other people. You would be interested in broadening and deepening your spiritual life. So it's become unpopular to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really amazing. Certainly in my area, up in North Jersey, where I got sober, if somebody came into the group and said, I've blown myself up, I'm really stupid, here's a list of all the stupid things I did this week, and man, am I an idiot, thank you for letting me share. Everybody's like, yay! And then if somebody raises their hand and says, dude, you know, there's a recovery process, and if you would pay some attention and spend some time with an experienced sponsor and go through the steps, you wouldn't be confronted with that crap anymore. You know, you would be able to outgrow all of that stupid foolishness. You know, get a clue. If somebody shared something like that, it would be like, whoa, you know, stay away from that guy. He's a Nazi. You know? So it's become unpopular to talk about recovery in some areas of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I like the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear that, you know, there's half of the fellowship would really wish this would go away. You know, it's not. But you know, it's got some inconvenient truths for half measure fellowship people. But I'll tell you, it's got the answer for survival for the real alcoholic, the hopeless alcoholic. So, you know, it needs to be understood. In this book, you know, I don't have a dust jacket on this. One of the crimes, one of the things that New York, did was they're really not supposed to mess with the 164. You know, there's a policy and a procedure that you really leave the first 164 pages alone. You know, and it's been voted on, and it's become very, very difficult for anybody to get in there and monkey with it. That's why the language is still sexist and archaic. It's because enough people who care really don't want anybody in there messing with this, especially the muttonheads from New York. You know, so I'm glad of that. One of the things, though, that they allow people to do is change the forwards to the editions, the different editions, and the dust jacket. Okay, that's fair game. So what happened when the fourth edition came out? On the dust jacket, if anybody has a first printing of the fourth edition, you'll be able to read the dust jacket where it basically says the text Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the basis of recovery for alcoholics in the past, you know, has remained unchanged. They basically were saying, you know, those poor old alcoholics back in the day had to use this to recover. And enough of us freaked out about, you know, how stupid could you be to put that on the dust jacket, that they changed it. So, you know, if you can find one of the first printings of the fourth edition, you'll see that. And that's when they allowed just somebody, whoever, to write up the dust jacket without passing it by anybody and publish it. The same thing happened with the foreword to the fourth edition, where they basically said, modem to modem, face to face. You know, it's the exact same thing, one alcoholic talking with another. Well, I got to tell you something, modem to modem is not the same thing as working face to face with another alcoholic, okay? I can be a 14-year-old beautiful girl modem to modem if I wanted to be. You know what I'm saying? How do you know what I'm telling you is true if I'm modem to modem? Face-to-face is how we engage the alcoholic. Face-to-face is how we convince them that we understand how you feel and where you've been. We were there. We've experienced what you're going through right now, and we're recovered. You know, we found a way out, and we would love to show you that way out. You know, that's what you do face to face. So enough of us who cared freaked out about that foreword to the fourth edition that they changed it. You know, so again, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a fundamentalist. I'm a conservative. I believe in this book because there's magic in the first 164. You go through the first 164 and you do it like a textbook, because it is our basic text. When you get to an exercise, you stop and you take it before you move on. You will have a recovery experience that will rocket you into the fourth dimension of reality. It happens with everyone who does it. That does not happen with the step book. That does not happen with the book Living Sober. It does not happen with the pamphlets. You know, this is our basic text. This is what transforms us. If we pay enough of attention to it and we're rigorous about practicing the principles in it. Now I'm going to get started reading it. The title page. I don't know about down here. Like I say, I am well pleased. I showed up about a month and a half ago in Statesville, you know, about 45 miles southwest of here. And I came from an area in North Jersey where the big book meetings were few and far between and the experienced sponsors were few and far between. And everything was just, you know, go in and share like it was a bad Bob Newhart, you know, therapy group, you know, without a trained counselor, you know. So we would have to drive 45 minutes, you know, to go to a big book meeting, and we'd show up at the other meetings, and that we weren't the most popular people in the room because we'd be talking about recovery. You know, I come from that area. I moved down here. I start going to meetings in Statesville, and everything's a solution based meeting. I'm like, you know, this is a fellowship I've been craving for my whole life. You know, so I really don't know what goes on. This is really my first meeting in Winston-Salem. You know, so if I sound a little condescending and, you know, you all get it, you know, you're all big book people, please, you know, I apologize. I'm just used to doing it the way I do it because there's just such a lack of experience and understanding where I come from. Anyway, there is a controversy about recovered or recovering up where I come from. You're looked on as very, very arrogant if you share you're a recovered alcoholic. We're supposed to be recovering, people say. Now, on the title page here, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, fourth edition. Okay, that's what the book says. The book uses the term recover. And here's how I justify that. And here's how I can accept that pretty much 100%. If you're cured of an illness, the illness is removed. If you're recovered from an illness, the symptoms of the illness are removed. The best we can have with alcoholism is to have the symptoms removed. We're always going to have alcoholism with us. Anyone in here who's been sober a long period of time and went back to drinking experienced one thing, and that was you didn't go back to where you were when you stopped. You went back to where you would have been if you kept going with the progression. Okay, I'm seeing some heads nod in here. That's because over any considerable period of time, alcoholism gets worse. It doesn't get better. It gets worse, whether you're drinking or not. And the science behind that is basically your liver and your pancreas get to a point where they start to deteriorate in their ability to process alcohol. So what happens is, even though you've been sober 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, your liver and your pancreas are still deteriorating in their ability to be able to process alcohol. That's why when you pick up a drink after 10, 20, or 30 years, you're rocketed back into acute alcoholism like you've never experienced before. And that's true with most alcoholics. So we'll always have the physical part of alcoholism. There's two things that can happen. One is you can die with alcoholism. The other is you can die from alcoholism. All right, I want to die with alcoholism. I don't want to die from alcoholism. So yes, I am an alcoholic, but I'm a recovered alcoholic. The symptoms of active alcoholism don't manifest in me today. Because I've gone through the steps and had a spiritual awakening, my spirit has been awakened. I don't suffer emotionally, mentally, or spiritually from the things that I suffered from prior to a recovery experience. So, Recovering. Here's another way to look at it. Let's say you're in the hospital and you're in the recovery room. What does that mean? That means that, you know, you're better, but you still need to be observed. You still need to be in the hospital. You're in the recovery room. When you're recovered, that means you've taken up your bed and you're walking again. That's the way they talk about in the book. All right, you can leave the hospital and you can go about your business and your daily affairs. So that's why I think we're recovered and we're not slowly recovering or whatever. What I've seen is the people who share they're slowly recovering usually aren't. You know, that's just kind of what I've seen. Let's see what else we got in here. The preface. All right, this is from the preface in the fourth edition. This is the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first edition appeared in April 39, and then the following 16 years, more than 300,000 copies went into circulation. The second edition, published in 1955, reached a total of more than 1,150,000 copies. The third edition, which came off the press in 1976, achieved a circulation of approximately 19 million in all of its formats. The book Alcoholics Anonymous is a real good seller. There's a lot of money to be made off of the publishing of this book. As a matter of fact, Alcoholics Anonymous basically uses this as a stopgap, the sales of literature as a stopgap. If they're not doing good with group contributions, they'll raise the price on literature a little, and that's how they manage to do their break even stuff. Because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such a large number of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth editions. That's not entirely true. Most of the changes were minor, but I've seen reports on all the changes. There's a whole ton of them. You know, there's like been 100 changes, but they've all been very, very small and usually grammatical. The second edition added the appendices, the 12 traditions, and the directions for getting in touch with AA. But the chief change was in the section of personal stories. You know, on the dust jacket of the fourth edition, you know, some people have it right now. They basically spend about a third of that dust jacket explaining why the personal stories are so much more important than most people give them credit for. All right. I see the personal stories as being great for identification. I think if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic or you're first being exposed to AA, I think reading the stories are great. Okay, but very few of the stories, there's some exceptions, very few of the stories talk about a recovery experience. They talk about how drunk they were and how they were exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous and how life is pretty good today. But they don't really explain the details of how they had that experience. And I'm not a huge fan of the stories. There was a story, there still is a story in this book, in the third edition was called Dr. Alcoholic Addict. And it became a favorite among people in the fellowship. It's a great story. You know, it's Dr. Paul was the guy who wrote it, and he was, you know, 3 or 5 years sober when he wrote it, and it was a great story, and it was all about his narcotics addiction and his alcoholism, and you know what it did was it brought a kind of a holistic look at, you know, addiction into the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it also talked about acceptance. You know, acceptance is the key was in a story, and people really kind of went to these things because they felt all warm and fuzzy. But when the fourth edition of the book was being hammered out, when they were making decisions on what stories to keep and what stories to get rid of, they were trying to get rid of Dr. Alcoholic Addict in a big way. And that's basically because they saw it as a threat to the primary purpose. I think the stories are important. I think they should be in the book, but I don't think the dust jacket should say that they're that important. They're important for identification. After we've identified, after it's ollie ollie oxen free, okay, I'm all in, tell me what to do, then you don't need them anymore. What you need is the first 164. Now, I've been to, up in New Jersey, there was one big book meeting when I first got sober, back in the late 80s. There was one big book meeting, and I had to drive four towns away to get to it. And in that big book meeting, what they did was they read every word in this book. And they would read a paragraph and share, read a paragraph and share. What that meant was, because of the length of the third edition, it meant that three quarters of the time we were reading a story. And we weren't paying attention to the recovery instructions in the first 164. We were reading some story on page 438. So I believe that the stories are important. I think that a lot of us have found identification there. Sometimes we've even found little tips and help for staying sober a day at a time. But they're not the heart of the book. The heart of the book is the first 164. And what they do in the different editions is they try to put together stories that newer Alcoholics Anonymous members can identify with. And to one degree or another, they're successful. Who knows? It happens. I don't really even know what the process is for choosing the stories. Forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That's something that's really good to remember. The main purpose of the book Alcoholics Anonymous is to show you precisely how to recover. Precisely. So much time is spent in meetings these days without covering the exact mechanics of that recovery process. I sponsor a Grapevine editor, and I love this guy. He's really my first sponsee. I've been sponsoring him for 20 years, and he's a Grapevine editor. And the Grapevine's pretty much in trouble right now. And it's in a catch-22 situation. What's going on with it is that every year its circulation drops a little bit. Really, more and more groups are trying to help by, groups subscribing to multiple copies and things. And that's helping a little. But what's happening is it's becoming less and less relevant. When you look at some of the studies that's being done on the Grapevine, you find that the median age of a Grapevine reader is getting older and older. It's basically up in the 60s now. The median age of a Grapevine reader is in the 60s. And it hasn't changed in a long time, the way it lays out stories. It's formulaic. It's really, if you pick up a Grapevine from 1962 and then one from last month, you're going to see that there's not really a whole lot of change in it. And this is making it less and less relevant to the newer members who are coming in. But the Grapevine board don't want to make any significant changes in format because they're afraid they're going to lose the subscription base that they have. And if they lose anybody else, it's going to become an AA decision to close it down. So, I get this from my guy who sits on the board at the Grapevine all the time. And one of the things that drives me crazy about the magazine is when you read the statement of purpose in there, it basically says that the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is basically anything anybody wants it to be. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous is anything any group wants it to be. We're so concerned about freedom of speech. We're so concerned about personal freedoms in Alcoholics Anonymous that we're making statements that go contrary to the recovery process in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I see that as divisive. I see that as really a threat to unity. If you know, one book is saying this and another book is saying that, that really goes against unity. Anyway, for them, we hope that these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. One of the things I know about Bill Wilson, you know, he's not a perfect person. You know, one of the great sayings is we are not saints, and Bill certainly wasn't. But what he was a visionary. He could see problems coming before anybody else could. He had the best perspective on the alcoholic personality and was able to basically put the architecture together for the recovery process. He was the principal architect for this book, and there was some amazing work being done when he was about 4 years sober. That is amazing to me today, that when this book was published, there really wasn't anybody with 5 years of sobriety. For some of the older members in here, some of the people who have been sponsoring for years and years and years, you kind of understand what that means. I still have problems, you know, leaving people alone in the house, you know, with less than 2 or 3 years, you know, in my house. You know what I'm saying? And these people put together the architecture of a recovery program. It is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. One of the things that they got wrong was they thought with publication of this book that this book would spread like wildfire, and all of a sudden they would be inundated with requests for help, and they just weren't going to be able to provide it, because there are only 100 people. They thought tens of thousands of people would be instantly asking for help, because they figured there had to be millions of alcoholics in America. Well, what really happened was they put some ads out. They threw some ads out there to doctors and, you know, mailed a bunch of postcards and really tried to sell this book. There was like a direct mail campaign. And they sent out all these postcards to practically every doctor that they could find an address on, you know, in America. And they gave it about a week, and then they figured, okay, by now all those requests for books have to be in the post office, and what we should go down there, with three big gunny sacks, because there's just going to be absolutely tons of these returned postcards requesting the book. And they went down there, and there was three. They went down there with gunny sacks, expecting, you know, that this was going to sell off the wall. And there was three cards written by doctors who were so drunk they couldn't even tell what the address was. The writing was so bad. So they got it wrong. This did not become a mail order sobriety, mail order recovery thing that they expected it to. Yes, there were people who got this book and were able to put it into application just by reading it, but that was really few and far between. What they found happened was one alcoholic needed to carry the message to another. This is a textbook, and as such, it needs to be taught. Let's say I gave you a textbook on how to fly one of the Blue Angel jets, okay? And it's this thick, and I give it to you, and I go, okay, read it, you know, and you read the whole manual, and okay, let's sit in the cockpit. Now fire this baby up, and let's take it around the block. You're going to be, whoa, you know. Textbooks need to be taught. There are examples and instructions and questions that need to be asked and things that need to be elucidated a little bit and explained a little bit. So this is a textbook, and they found it really did need to be taught. For one alcoholic really did need to be carrying the message to another for Alcoholics Anonymous to spread. And that really is what happened. So you have to remember that anonymity in the beginning was designed to keep these guys from having no life. They figured if there was 10,000 people that needed help, we're not going to be able to sleep. That was one of the main reasons for anonymity. There's other reasons for anonymity, and they're all valid reasons, but we have to understand anonymity today. In this day and age, nothing is hurting alcoholics more out there in the world than misunderstandings about anonymity. People think anonymity means secrecy. I'm sober. I need to stick my head in the sand. I need to be below the radar. I don't want anybody seeing my car in the parking lot out here. Yes, they've seen me projectile vomit up and down the supermarket aisle, but I don't want them to see my car. In the clubhouse parking lot. There's a misunderstanding about what anonymity is. What anonymity is we do not. We do not identify ourselves as members of Alcoholics Anonymous with a picture of our face or our last name if we're saying we are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? We also do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. This is really the principle of anonymity. Should we be telling people we're in we're recovered alcoholics that we went through treatment and we've done some support group work we've participated in our own sobriety and recovery? Should we be saying that? Yes, we should, because we want to place ourselves at a place where we're of maximum benefit to our fellow man, especially alcoholics. And if we're hiding the fact that we're in AA or that we're sober alcoholics, how are we really doing that? You know what I mean? So this anonymity thing really needs to be looked at. Now, each of us has to come to terms with what it means. How do we apply the principles of anonymity to our own lives and still be effective carriers of the message out there in the world? Look, we can all come to meetings. We can all come to meetings with the same 12 people every single week, and we can heal the healed. And we can save the saved if we want to. But what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to be carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholics. So we need to somehow internalize our relationship with anonymity to include, being of service, being able to help other people. We are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no dues or fees whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Okay. Here's another piece of very controversial thing. There's been times up in our area. I was the treatment facilities chair for a while with our inner group, with our general service office. And one of the big complaints from meetings was the places were putting people on the bus and sending them to the meetings, and they were drug addicts, and they were being coached by the treatment facilities to identify themselves as having a desire to stop drinking. I'm Harry. I have a desire to stop drinking. And this was causing a lot of controversy, and there were group members that were really pissed off, and they wanted this to stop, and all kinds of controversy. Groups exploded over it. I've seen hostile group conscience meetings, where there's half the room is on one side, let's help everybody, half the room is on the other side, the primary purpose. And it just got really, really ugly. My personal belief is, and I don't think any of us should be AA police. I really don't. To be able to look into someone's soul and make a decision on whether they really should be here or not is playing God. And we're really not supposed to play God anymore. That's one of the requirements of the third step. Now, how I feel about it is this. If you have a drinking problem, and a drinking history, or you abuse alcohol and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you may not be what this book would describe as a real alcoholic. You may not have lost all power, choice, and control in drink. You may not have gone down the scale like some people have. But is it right? Is it good for you to be addressing your alcohol problem with a support group? You know, I have to believe that it is. I have to believe that it is. If it takes one more drunk driver off the road, you know, I'm all for it. But what we need to do, what we need to see, and it comes from studying the first step in this book, is we have to see what the scale of alcoholism is. When it says, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll find that our experience can benefit others. There's another section in here that says, our ability to quit drinking on a non-spiritual basis will depend upon how much choice in drink we've lost, how much power in drink we have lost. So this is scale. One of the things that you hear all the time, some are sicker than others, that's absolutely true. We get everybody from alcohol abusers to hopeless, real, low-bottom alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And again, I'm all for that. I think it would be foolish and it would be selfish to, you know, try to carve out a pure alcoholic, you know, from the milieu of people that show up here. You know, who am I? But what we need to understand is, we need to understand that if we've gone down the scale further than some of the other people, we're going to have to be about the business of recovery a little bit more strenuous than others. I don't know about anybody else, but when I first got sober, I was going to some meetings where people were not, they did not go down the scale as far as I went. There was a meeting I went to, it was called the Duffer Meeting, where they'd talk about golf. These were a bunch of white, upper middle class, you know, Republican kind of guys who all got together, you know, and had their little clique, and they didn't like a bunch of outsiders, and they came and, you know, they put their dollar in the basket and they drank their coffee and they talked about the country clubs, and I'm going to these groups shaking like a leaf. And they didn't need to do the work that I needed to do to recover. They could talk about golf and they were okay. We need to understand that there's a scale of alcoholism. We need to personally understand where we are, because that is going to determine how much effort we need to put into our own recovery process. We can't get sober the way he does or she does. We can't. We'll die if we've gone down the scale further than they have. And this is another thing that they don't talk about a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it needs to be said because people are dying behind it. They're going to groups where, you know, people are trying to love them back to health. They're not taking them through the steps. They're not giving them service commitments. They're patting them on the head and telling them, just keep coming back. And they're dying. So we need to understand the scale of alcoholism. We need to understand that for the people we work with, you know, people who ask us to sponsor them or for us to be their spiritual advisors or whatever, other mentors, however you want to put it, we need to understand where they are on the scale, and we need to understand where we are on the scale. And we need to not be prejudiced about where anybody else is on the scale. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. It talks about Bill's trip out to Akron in here. You know, it's a funny story. When you think about where we come from, okay, sometimes we get up on our high horse about our Alcoholics Anonymous membership. Understand that the two co-founders, one of them was a stock shyster speculator. What his job was to convince you he knew a good stock, have you give him money, he would put money on that stock and take a percentage of it. That's total hustle, folks. Okay, I don't know how much you know about Wall Street, but that's pathetic hustle. So we got a shyster stockbroker speculator and a failed proctologist, a guy who couldn't find any more proctors to work on because he had these big hands and he shook like a leaf. And when he was heading for your proctor, you were asking for a second opinion. You know what I'm saying? That's where we come from. Those are our two co-founders. Now, some other interesting things is Bill Wilson is sober about 6 months. Okay. And he's still trying these hustles. You ever sponsor somebody in their first 6 months and they got a new idea? You know, I just figured something out. I'm not doing drugs anymore, so if I sold cocaine, I'd really make some money, you know? That's one of the buttes, you know, as far as newcomer ideas, that's one of the buttes. So his idea was, I'll get all these investors together and I'll go to Akron and we'll have a proxy battle and we'll take over this rubber company. It was like one of the tire companies out in Akron. And so he was going to go there and he was going to take it over and he was going to be the president. You know, is that beautiful? He was, you know, he's talked all these guys into getting on the train with him and they're going to take this company over. They're all going to make $1 million. And he gets out there and the whole thing falls apart. And everybody is so pissed off at him that they just leave him there and they get back on the train to go back to New York. He's got no money. He's got no place to stay. His whole plans and designs have blown up. And he wanders into the Mayflower Hotel. And over here is the bar. And over here is the church directory. Now, we are here by seconds and inches, folks. Picture this. He's sober 6 months. You know, his world is just blown up. There's a bar where everybody's having a really good time over here. And there's a church directory over there, you know. Which way is he going to go? Now, what he does is he goes over to the church directory. He's got like a dollar left. He gets a bunch of nickels for the phone calls. And he starts calling the people on the church directory. And this is basically what he's saying. Hey, my name's Bill Wilson. I'm a rummy from New York, and I need to talk to another rummy. And, you know, 9 out of 10 phone calls, here's what you heard. Click. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know about you guys, but I'd be hanging up on somebody like that. He gets to this one reverend called Walter Tunks. And the reason why Walter entertains his phone call is because Walter Tunks has been exposed to the Oxford group. What happened? This is a beautiful story. Bill Wilson got sober by being 12-step by Abby Thatcher. He was brought into the Oxford group, and in the Oxford group, they had procedures and they had spiritual principles and spiritual exercises that basically were our 12 steps, and it helped Bill to get sober. What happened in Akron was there was a beautiful drunk named Bud Firestone. He was from the Firestone Tire Company, okay? And Bud was like, anybody ever see that movie Arthur? You know, with Dudley Moore? All right, that's what Bud Firestone was like. He was like a complete embarrassment to his billionaire family. And, you know, they'd ship him off just to try to get him out of the way. Now, one of the times they shipped him off to New York, and he got exposed to the Oxford Group people, Frank Buchman and Sam Shoemaker and a bunch of the Oxford Group people, and he got sober. He got sober and he recovered. He got a spiritual awakening because it was like a religious conversion experience is basically what he had, which is very akin to the spiritual awakening that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came back to Akron and the whole family was, you know, oh my God, you know, Bud, what happened? You're a different person. You know, you've been healed. And he said, well, it was the Oxford Group people. So the Firestone family was so grateful to these Oxford Groupers that they brought the whole contingent from New York out to Akron, like a couple of hundred of them. And they took over the churches for like about a month, where all they were doing was witnessing and getting people fired up about the spiritual recovery, the spiritual tenets of the Oxford Group. And And what happened was Ann Smith was basically one of those people who got dragged into this. She was bringing Dr. Bob along to these Oxford group meetings. Now, what we need to kind of see, some of the lessons from these early days, I think, need to be told. Bill Wilson, when he was exposed to the Oxford group, got busy. He went early, he stayed late, and he asked everybody if there's anything else he can do. When they said, "Bill, we need you to witness down on 42nd Street," he jumped up on the soapbox and he witnessed. He was dragging people out of the bars and bringing them to the meetings. So he was bringing people in. He was doing the steps. He was making his apologies and his amends to his business people. He was about the business of spiritual living. And he stayed sober. Dr. Bob, on the other hand, for 3 years or so, was being dragged into the Oxford group meetings by his wife. And he was a reluctant participant. He came late, he left early, and he kept his mouth shut and didn't get involved. And guess what? He was drunk the whole time, okay? Does that ring a bell for anybody in here that sponsors people, you know? Our level of participation is directly proportional to our chances of recovery. God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. So how then shall I cooperate? You know, and no one is more defensive. No one is more evasive than the alcoholic as far as doing the things that will save their own life. And it's because, you know, who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Alcoholism doesn't allow us an accurate self-appraisal on most occasions. Anyway, when Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson got together, now think about this. Dr. Bob is a surgeon. He's not just a doctor, he's a surgeon. Anybody in here know any surgeons? You ever hear them say they don't know something? They are the I know everything people of the entire world. They're surgeons. They've been trained to know. They've been trained to have no doubt about anything, okay? Bill Wilson is a stockbroker, shyster guy who's blown his life up. He goes and he talks to Dr. Bob at the Cyberling Estate, and he brings Dr. Bob the medical estimate of alcoholism. So here a surgeon is learning about the medical estimate of alcoholism from a shyster stockbroker, and he's paying attention. As a matter of fact, he becomes convinced. Folks, we are here by seconds and inches. You know what I mean? That could have gone the other way. That could have gone the other way. Not only was Dr. Bob a surgeon, but he was a very hungover surgeon during that first visit. He could have had enough real quick. What happens is he becomes convinced. He has a relapse, but he becomes convinced that there's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. He now gets why he can't stay away from alcohol. He gets it now because Bill explains it to him the way it's explained in the doctor's opinion. Another thing that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, which I think can be damaging to the classification of alcoholics that's classified as hopeless or low bottom in this book, okay? And that is, kid, just don't drink no matter what. If I could do that, you know, would I be asking a 60-year-old plumber to help me with my life? You know what I mean? I can't not drink. I've known for 10 years that putting alcohol in my body is a bad idea. The milkman knows it's a bad idea. I know it's a bad idea. What happens is alcohol ends up in my body anyway. I'm not even there for the decision. It talks in this book about suddenly. Has anybody ever had suddenly hit you? Suddenly the thought crosses your mind that a little bit of vodka in the milk won't hurt you on a full stomach. So here's how. You know, Listen, when suddenly hits you, you ain't got time to take a coffee commitment. You don't have time to call your sponsor. You don't have time to do the steps. Suddenly is on you and you're drinking. That is what was explained to Dr. Bob. And that's the problem. That's the first step problem, that you have no power, choice, and control, and your life is unmanageable on every level. That's the first step truth, and it's not a fun one to internalize. The second step that Bill basically convinced Dr. Bob was, all those things they're asking you to do in that meeting, Bob, just do them. Don't complain about them. Don't dodge and weave. Don't avoid them. Get in there and do. And he started to do those things, and he got and stayed sober. It has so much to do with our participation. Is God involved in all this? You all know God is. Without the grace of God, without the power of God, we can't take our next breath, let alone recover from alcoholism. But if God alone kept us sober, this would be a very short book. There would be one page where it says, God keeps you sober, ask him, okay? And then we'd all be recovered. But that's not the case. There's a participation process. There's work that we have to do. There's a commitment we have to make. Our participation in this recovery process, and that's what this book talks about. There's great information in the second the forward to the second edition here. In this forward, it basically talks about some of the expectations for long-term sobriety. Now, when you talk about statistics in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to understand that it's not an exact science. Statistics in an anonymous fellowship are not going to be scientific. But what we can do is we can observe some patterns, and we can observe some truth about what goes on ourselves. And what they observed and what they put in this book was, for people who really tried the program, 50% of them sobered up at once. 25% sobered up after some relapse. 25% showed some improvement. And that's some of the observations that they came up with. I've found that's true today. It's how do you define people who really tried? I don't define people who really tried by people who do 90 and 90. I define people who really tried by the people who do the fourth and the fifth step, who become as honest as they can be, who, humbly on their knees ask God to remove the character defects, who go out and actually make direct amends to the people in the institutions who their character defects have caused harm to, and then who develop disciplines of prayer and meditation and then actually go out and work with other alcoholics. Those are people, I believe, who really try. And I think the statistics are even better than 75% for people that do that. So there's good information in some of these earlier writings, and it's a good idea to cover it. I'm going to stop tonight and pretend that I covered the forward to the second edition. What I really don't want to do, guys, is sit here and read word for word out of the big book. I don't want to read your big book for you. You need to read your big book yourself. I can share my experience, strength, and hope, some observations that I've come up with, from the different experiences that I've had. But please understand that you need your own experience with this. This is not something that can be learned intellectually. It needs to be learned experientially. This is an experiential recovery program. And each of us needs to do the things that we need to do to be able to get it. We've got a few minutes left. I think this meeting goes till 9:30 or so, and you know, I'll call on hands if anybody wants to share.